Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Rabbi Schweiger discusses Parshat Matot. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member of Pardes and serves as the Pardes Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Thank you, Larry. This week's Parsha is Parshat Matot. I would like to examine the opening section, which deals with the question of vows. Let us look at the opening verse, chapter 30, verse 3. If a man takes a vow, or takes an oath, and thereby prohibits something upon himself, he shall not render his word null. According to all that issues from his mouth, he shall do. This verse is dealing with a general situation of what does it mean to take a vow. And although the verse says, ish, a man, it does not come to exclude a woman, because in principle the laws of vows apply to women as well. What it excludes is someone who is a minor. The rabbis understand that a child who approaches the age of a man has the ability to take a vow and for that vow to be valid. By saying the word ish, the Torah is trying to express that taking vows requires a certain maturity, an understanding, a seriousness of the full weight and responsibility of what is happening. We are told in this verse of two different ways in which one can prohibit something. One is a vow, the other is an oath. In a vow, a neder, one prohibits the object. In an oath, one is prohibiting the person. To illustrate this, if I say these crackers are forbidden, I can say the crackers are forbidden to be eaten by me. Or in general, these crackers shall be forbidden to be eaten. In effect, I have now given the crackers a status of being a prohibited food. And according to the rabbinic understanding, they are being prohibited as one would prohibit a holy object, a sacrifice. But I can also take an oath, where it is not the crackers that are prohibited, but it is me. I forbid myself to eat these crackers. To illustrate the difference between the two, on Pesach, the Torah prohibits the eating of chametz, bread, any type of leavened products. The object itself is something which is prohibited. Not only is it prohibited to be eaten, it is prohibited to derive benefit, it is prohibited to be in my premises. On Yom Kippur, the food is not prohibited. The person is prohibited to eat. The person is commanded to afflict his soul. This is the difference between an oath and a vow. In this verse, the Torah is telling us, whichever mechanism one uses, they need to appreciate the magnitude of what they're doing, the power of what they're doing, the holiness of what they're doing. And therefore the Torah says, Lo yachel dvaro, do not render your words null. Do not violate what you said, and by doing so, make a travesty of your words. Divest them of any meaning. Rather, according to all that issues from your mouth, you shall do. There is a very interesting rabbinic comment on this verse, which says, you shall not render your words worthless, but an expert, a court, can do it. And the Talmud says on the basis of this verse, we derive the idea of hatarat nedarim, of releasing vows. The idea being that if I take a vow and somehow feel that I am incapable of continuing to fulfill it, there is this option of being released from my vow. It's a procedure. I need to either go to what's called a mumche, an expert in releasing vows, or gather together a court of three men and ask to be released. It's not just enough to say I would like to be released, but they have to be able to find a petach, an opening, a way of saying, had you realized X, Y, and Z when you took the vow, would you have taken it? And by somehow finding this opening, this mistake, they are able to release the vow retroactively. Therefore, in the opening verse of our parsha, it says that Moshe spoke to the heads of the tribes. Why is Moshe addressing this section to the heads of the tribes? And it would seem to be, given what I just said, because the heads of the tribes have this ability to release vows. In fact, Nachmanides says that it is very important that this is something which was given to the heads of the tribes, so that in the end, people would not treat the vows lightly, as a way of somehow hiding this option of releasing vows, something which the heads of the tribes know of, but not the general population, so that people will not take vows lightly because they feel, well, we easy come, easy go. We can take it upon ourselves lightly, but we can just as easily invalidate it. The continuation of our section speaks about two specific situations of vows of a young woman who takes a vow in her father's house and of a married woman who takes a vow. And in both instances, there is a right which is given to the father and to the husband to invalidate these vows. Let us look, verse 4. If a woman shall take a vow to God and prohibited something in her father's house, bin ureha, in her youth, in verse 5, and her father will hear her vow, and the prohibition which she has taken upon herself, if the father is silent, then the vow shall be upheld, and all that she has prohibited upon herself shall stand. But in verse 6, if the father shall now nullify on the day that he hears the vow, all of her vows shall not stand, and God will forgive her because her father nullified it. Let us understand the various elements that are described in these verses. First, the regulations described here govern vows made by a daughter in her father's house when she is a na'ara. According to the rabbinic understanding, a na'ara is a girl from the age of 12 to 12 and a half, which means that this allowance is for a very, very limited situation. And what we're told is, during that time framework, the girl is seen as being in the domain of her father, so that the father has the right power to invalidate or uphold her vows. In verse 6, it speaks about the father nullifying her vow on the day that he hears of it. And from this, the rabbis derive, the father is given that day where he hears of the vow. That day meaning, from the point where he hears until sunset, he has the right to invalidate it. If he invalidates it, it is null and void. But if he validates it, or even if he's silent, the vow is upheld. Here we have an exception to the rule which we mentioned in verse 3. In verse 3, it seems that when someone takes a vow, the moment they take the vow, it has a life of its own, and they are bound by it, and they are expressly prohibited from violating it. Lo yachel dvaro. In our section, although the girl has taken the vow, there still is the possibility that that vow will not take effect if her father invalidates it on the day that it was taken. At the end of verse 6, after having said that the father has the ability to invalidate the vow, it says, and God will forgive her because her father invalidated it. Rashi quotes an interesting rabbinic comment which addresses an implicit question. Namely, why should the verse be speaking about God forgiving this woman if in fact the father has invalidated the vow, then nothing wrong has happened. So why is there a need for forgiveness? And Rashi quotes a rabbinic comment which says that even if the woman violated the vow after the father invalidated it, being unaware of his invalidation, where one could say from her perspective, she was committing a sin, even though objectively speaking, she didn't. Hence the Torah says, God will forgive her. God will judge her, not in terms of her intention, but in terms of the objective reality. The objective reality being that at the time she violated her vow, it was invalid. Nachmanides offers a different explanation. He says that the Torah is actually teaching us that only if she violated the vow after her father invalidated it, will she be forgiven by God. But what if she made the vow and then immediately violated it? And later on, that day, the father invalidated it, she has committed a sin. And God will not forgive her unless she repents. And why? Because the rabbinic understanding is that there is a difference between what is called hafarat nedarim, the right of a father to invalidate a vow, versus hatarat nedarim, releasing a vow, which is done, as we said earlier, by the Beit Din, or the mumche, the expert. In hatarat nedarim, the vow is retroactively undone. So that whenever the person violates the vow, if it's retroactively undone, there is no crime that's been committed. In hafarat nedarim, the vow is invalidated from that point on. Which means that when the vow was taken, it is in effect. It is only at a certain point where it is broken. And therefore, Nachmanides says, so the Torah is making it clear, if the woman does it after the invalidation, God will forgive her. If it is done before, she is held accountable. Sforno has another take on it. Sforno, the medieval Italian commentary, says, why is there a need for forgiveness? Because she took a vow which is not within her capacity to fulfill. And he goes on to say, she did not realize what her father was thinking, what her father wanted when she took the vow. She took the vow with the intention of fulfilling it. What is the Sforno saying? What the Sforno is saying is, there is no issue here like Rashi and Ramban that the woman actually violated her vow. And then the only question is, was there malicious intent? Was it done before the invalidation? Was it done after the invalidation? According to Sforno, taking a vow may very well be problematic. He specifically highlights, if her father invalidates the vow, then the girl should not have taken this vow to begin with. She should have realized that this is something which is inappropriate. It raises a much more general issue, as I mentioned at the very beginning. When anyone takes a vow, do they think through the full ramifications of the vow? In some cases that may mean, can I really live up to what this vow is demanding of me? Can I really be fully responsible in executing this vow? But there are other considerations. How does this vow impact on other people? And especially in this case, where clearly the father has a say in her vow, if he invalidates it, then evidently she was not sensitive enough to how this would impact on her father, and how could she then say words which ultimately have no meaning, or which could very easily be divested of their meaning. And this is why God needs to forgive her. When we go on to read further in the section, it speaks of a similar right of a husband to invalidate the vows of his wife. And I would just like to look at one verse. This is verse 14. It says, any vow or any oath which is to afflict the soul. Her husband shall uphold it, her husband shall invalidate it. And later on, in verse 17, it says, these are the laws which God commanded Moshe between a man and his wife, between a father and daughter. The rabbis understand, based on these two verses, that there are two types of vows which a husband, and most commentaries understand, a father, have the ability to invalidate. First, a vow which is le'anot nafesh, which is coming to afflict one's soul. Any type of vow which could be seen as somehow being afflictive to the person, to the woman, the husband has the right to invalidate. If the woman now says she will not eat, or even if she says, I will not eat fruits, that is seen as being a vow of affliction. Second type, any type of vow which impacts on their interpersonal relationship, bein ish liishto, which may have to do with their sexual relationships in the limited sense or maybe in a broader sense. Those are the vows which a husband has the ability to invalidate. Let me just add that there actually could be a situation where you have a young girl who is the age of 12, who is betrothed, engaged, and where in order to invalidate her vow, you need both the father and the husband to invalidate it. Right now, I'm not interested in going into the details of all these situations. But what I am interested in looking at is that the Torah gives the father, the husband, the ability to invalidate vows which are made by the daughter, by the wife. This is a unique allowance which is made, and perhaps because it is seen as something which in the end could negatively impact on the nature of their relationship, negatively impact on the person. What I see happening in this section is that the Torah, on the one hand, is allowing for the releasing or the invalidation of vows. But perhaps much more significantly, the Torah is trying to highlight the seriousness of vows. And that vows, as I mentioned in the beginning, should not be treated lightly, should not be divested of their meaning. This section begins our parsha and is then carried through in a later section in chapter 33 with a story about the tribes of Reuven and Gad who were seeking to get their inheritance on the eastern side of the Jordan. And we've spoken about this in a previous podcast, and I will not go through this, all of the negotiations which go on. And clearly there are extensive negotiations because the issue of speech and clarity of speech are at the core here. The idea of people being aware of the full ramifications of what they want. If B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven take their inheritance on the eastern side of the Jordan, how will that impact on the Jewish people? If Moshe agrees to that, he has to be sensitive to what that will do to everyone else, how that can be perhaps demoralizing. What I would like to just look at are two things. First, Moshe makes an agreement with the two tribes, and he actually tells this agreement in chapter 32, verse 28. He charges, commands Eleazar the priest, Yoshua bin Nun, the heads of the tribes of the Jewish people. Note the heads of the tribes of the Jewish people. The same language which opens up the parsha. Moshe charges them with the following, the terms of the agreement. Verse 29, verse 30. If the tribes of Reuven and Gad will cross over the Jordan, all of them who will be a bridgehead before God, and the land will be conquered before them, then you shall give them the land of Gilead as their inheritance, as their possession. But if they do not travel ahead of the camp, then they shall take their possession in the land of Canaan. Moshe very clearly sets up the terms which the tribe of Reuven and Gad are interested in. You want to take possession of the land? You have to be the ones who lead the battle. And as I mentioned a moment ago, Moshe is very concerned that this should not be a demoralizing element. They have to show the people that they will be in the forefront of the battle. And not only that, but will not take possession of the land until everyone else has received their inheritance. The rabbis, based on these verses, learn that any time there is a conditional agreement, it has to be doubled, meaning it has to be stated in the positive and the negative. And there are many conditions, but let's just say for the moment, the positive has to precede the negative. This is what is known in rabbinic terminology as tnai kaful, a double condition. And one could ask, why is this necessary? If we are told, if you cross over, engage in battle, wait until everybody receives their possession, then you will be given the eastern part of the Jordan, then why do we have to be told the inverse? That should be something which is obvious. And in fact, in Masechet Kiddushin, in the Mishnah, there is an opinion which says, it's not obvious. It's not obvious because one might have said, if you don't do that which I'm asking you, then you will forfeit any possession of the land. That's not what it says by us. By us it says, if you don't cross over, instead of getting the eastern side, you will get a portion together with everyone else on the western side. What that shows us is that it is not always obvious what the terms are. And therefore, whenever you make a conditional agreement, it has to be perfectly clear. It has to be perfectly clear so that people know exactly what are the ramifications, so that when you take something upon yourself, it is with full consciousness. Once again, this is highlighting the holiness of speech. When I take a vow, I need to realize how that vow will impact on me, on others. To what degree can I really live up to what this is demanding of me? And by the same token, the tribes of Gad and Reuven have to realize what the full ramifications are of each option which they will exercise. And then we're told in verse 31, and the tribes of Gad and the tribe of Reuven said, whatever God said to your servants, we shall do. They clearly take upon themselves with full consciousness the charge which Moshe gave to the heads of the tribes. I want to jump for a moment to the book of Dvarim, chapter 23, where it talks about taking a vow to God, making a sacrifice. In chapter 23, verse 22, when you take a vow to the Lord your God, do not delay in paying it, because God will seek it out from you, and there will be in you a sin. When you stop to vow, there will not be in you a sin. Verse 24, that which comes out of your mouth, guard and do. As you vow to God, that which you said with your mouth. We have verses in Ecclesiastes which echo what I just read, but I just want to quote one of the verses. This is in chapter 5, verse 4. Good that you should not vow, then you should vow and not pay up. The verses which I just read are speaking specifically about vows which are being made to God, sacrifices, free-willed offerings. And the Torah is saying, when you make such a vow, don't delay in paying it. And there are various regulations. Any sacrifices which are vowed need to be brought within the cycle of three pilgrimages. What I want to bring out with these verses is that the Torah sees the inherent danger in taking vows, which is that people do not take it seriously enough. People promise all kinds of things, but are lax. Sometimes they may delay, sometimes they may not do it at all. Sometimes they may betray their words. And therefore Ecclesiastes says, better that you don't take something upon yourself than commit yourself and not come through. I would like to end today's session by going back to the very beginning of the parsha. The parsha begins that Moshe spoke to the heads of the tribes. And the question is, why should the section of vows be directed to the heads of the tribes? One explanation which I gave earlier is because they have the ability to release vows. I want to offer another explanation, which is actually found in a modern commentary called Moznayim LeTorah by the Tel's Rav. He says this section is addressed to the leadership of the Jewish people. And speaking in a very modern way, he says, it is very typical that when people, leaders, are vying to be elected, they make all kinds of election promises, which they renege on once they're elected. And although some people may see this as being a very nice sermon, but I think there's a very profound truth in what he is saying. It is human nature that people take upon themselves much more than they bite off more than they can chew. Sometimes it is done with very good intentions. People sincerely, honestly, would like to push themselves further and therefore commit themselves to something because they really believe in it. But believing in something is not enough. You need to also be realistic. You need to be methodical. You can't just have a dream, but you also have to have some sort of paper, some sort of strategy. How are you going to implement it? Position paper. That's in the case where a person is well-intentioned. But there are also situations where people take upon themselves things to make an impression, where they never had any intent from the beginning to really do it. But it sounds great. What our parasha is basically doing is trying to impress upon people, and perhaps it is saying from the leadership down, take seriously what you say. For the person who is well-intentioned, don't say things unless you can back it up. Don't say things, don't commit yourself unless you can follow through. And for the person who is ill-intentioned, the Torah is in effect saying, you will pay a price. This is a sin. You need God to forgive you. And although that last point is not hammered through in our parsha, because perhaps our parsha is not assuming willful or gross negligence in carrying through vows, that is certainly a theme which comes up in Dvarim, and certainly in Ecclesiastes. The vows we take, the commitments that we make, are things that should be sacred. Before we take them upon themselves, we should appreciate the full magnitude of what we're saying. And once we've taken it upon ourselves, do everything possible to implement them. If we look at the end of the parsha, it seems to be that the inheritance of the land is very much a function of the seriousness of the commitment of Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven on the one hand, and of the leadership on the other hand, to see that it is carried through. May we learn to measure our words carefully. May we learn to come through on whatever commitments we make. Better not to make a vow than to make a vow and not pay up. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Your comments on the podcast are always important to us, so please send an email to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.